In just a moment, our friend Colin Fleming joins us. He's got a great new piece at RollingStone.com about recording from 50 years ago that's finally seeing the light of day. It's The Who, live at Fillmore East, 1968. Let's give you a little taste of it right now.
Thank you. We can't have the last one for tonight now. And we thank everyone again for coming. And anyone that's just come in, don't worry, because the next one's going to last quite a long time. How long, we don't know. Not all that long. Long enough to get into it, innit? And this is an old one. And a goodie. It's on my list of classics. Oh dear. And it's My Generation.
Colin Fleming joining us. And Colin, this was a cut that was rumored for years to be out there. 33 minutes of awesomeness from The Who, and it is the real deal. What were your overall impressions of this live performance?
Shocked that it actually existed. I'd heard about it for a long time, really. This was one of the, well, some of these tapes, the portions of these tapes, were among the first bootlegs that ever existed in popular music back in the early 1970s. And the bootleg version of this recording, two gigs from the Fillmore East, early April 1968, had a version of My Generation that was from a different night. It was not this 33-minute version. And so you heard rumors that this half-hour-plus version was out there, but it was just really Holy Grail type of stuff. The Who didn't do songs that long ever. If you listen to the Live at Leeds, My Generation, that's 14 and a half minutes, and just didn't exist. So it was really revelatory to me to hear this for the first time.
I learned from your piece, I didn't know, that the Who were really at a turning point at this juncture in 68. They were a singles band, sales weren't going all that well, and they weren't sure they could keep it going until this and then what was to follow.
A singles band who did very arty kind of singles, the sort of emotional intensity to them as well. I think of them as almost these emotional agitproppers. And then at their gigs, they infamously destroyed their instruments. And as you know, when you're home and you're rocking out in your den and you smash your Telecaster, the price mounts. It was eating away at the coffers. And they really didn't know what to do. The singles in 68, like Magic Bus, were flopping, and they were on the verge of a breakup. It's like, you're in the NFL, what's the average NFL career? It's like 3.1 years or something. Well, bands, right? They last even less time. Think of all the bands. Either you were in a band or I was in a band. Someone we know was in a band. And you're probably not having a 25-year reunion tour right now. So they were in trouble. And what you hear, my big premise, in this half-hour-plus version of My Generation, the single from 3 years prior, was the birth of the rock opera Thomas, a.k.a. Tommy, on stage in the various leitmotifs that the band is working out in front of your very ears.
And that would change everything for them. And as you also point out in the Rolling Stone piece, and I find this fascinating too, because we take it for granted now. But people in 1968 didn't really have a full appreciation of the musicianship, the overall talent of either Pete Townshend or Keith Moon.
No, they really didn't. And I would say that Pete Townshend is the greatest guitarist in the history of rock and roll. I think he's a better guitarist than Hendrix. Not that he could play better than Hendrix, because he can't. Not even close. Hendrix is someone who would play circles around Townshend when it comes to soloing and everything. But Townshend used the guitar compositionally. He used the guitar as though he were Bach making Art of Fugue, and he would have a motif here, and that motif would resolve later on. He would do the same thing with chords, and it's very intricate. If you listen to like a live Led Zeppelin performance from 1969, you will hear so much open space in their sound. Jimmy Page is the lone guitarist, like Townshend was the lone guitarist in The Who, can't fill. You could drive a Mack truck through Zeppelin sound, and the Who, they're tight. And a lot of that is Townsend and these ideas he's developing. And if you listen to this version of this song, he's basically the conductor, and his guitar works as a form of punctuation, really. Power chords. They're not so much end of sentence, like here's a period, but they're M dashes, they're semicolons, they're leading everyone off in this direction now. And then Moon to me is even more of a gifted player than Townsend. I don't think anyone in popular music has played their instrument better than Keith Moon plays the drums. And it's interesting. It almost puts me in mind because you wouldn't think it's very similar, but Thackeray was this, you know, obviously fiction writer, but he was a critic and he hated everything. And he was talking about Dickens and the Christmas Carol. And he said, you know what, this guy, he did something nice for you here. He's helping out your soul. And when I hear Keith Moon drum, as much of like a crazy person as he was, who some days he'd get up and he'd decide he was going to be Hitler that day and he'd put on a little mustache and that's just what you had to deal with. He always felt to me like he was doing something for the goodness of your soul with the way he played drums, and this live recording is a good example of that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown in this 33-minute version of My Generation. What are a couple of the musical hints that sort of give us a preview of what we'll get in Tommy?
Well, you hear, for instance, the beginning of Overture from Tommy, and if we talk about the most famous chords in Western civilization, like what are some of them? Wagner, the so-called Tristan chord, the Beatles twice, right? And they're almost an inversion of each other. You have the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night, right? And then you have the concluding chord of A Day in the Life. They're sort of like mirror pieces, but antipodes in a way. And then you have that chord that begins Tommy. And it's funny because the chord is slightly off key. And then sort of that leitmotif, that guitar progression begins. You hear that a number of times throughout this 30-plus minute version. You hear elements of Sparks, which was this dialogue, really, between John Entwistle's bass and Moon's drums. And you heard some of that before with the track Rayel from The Who Sell Out, that concept album from 67. But it's not with the same level of finesse. Townsend was a genius writer, and when people, like music critics, they tell you someone's a great writer, what do they almost always do? They quote lyrics. That's not what this kind of writing is about. It's the actual music. Townsend probably can't actually read music, but it's the music that he wrote. And even for me, like as a writer, I would hear how he would transition through different passages with the guitar, or the acoustic guitar, and he would salt away an idea in your head to make it pay off later. And to hear people do that on the stage, it's a finesse that you get almost like with 1945 bebop, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie. But here is this three-piece rock band, proto-heavy metal band, with the singer doing the same kind of thing.
We also hear, and we got a little taste of it in the brief cut that we played, there's a lot of chatter, a lot of stage banter with Townsend here that you didn't always hear in Who concerts later on.
No, they're bootlegs, and it's a shame because The Who, if they wanted to, they are the best live band of all time. If they wanted to, they could release archival performances that would cement that reputation. The Philly 73 show, Toronto 75, Dallas 67, San Francisco 71, Charlton 76. But for some reason, they don't really give you very much. But Townsend was a metaphysician, really, on stage. There's the My Generation that you don't get with this release from the bootleg, so keep your bootleg copy. He talks about loading his luggage and comparing that to playing the guitar. And it's almost this kind of Baudelaire-esque ennui crossed, ironically, with a fierce determination to carry on. And they were funny. He was always funny. He was very loquacious. And a bootleg like this would have been sold. It was on the trademark of Quality label. And you know how we have food trucks now. You would have turned up at a gig, and out of the back of someone's pickup truck, he would have milk cartons full of these bootlegs. And this was one of the first ones you would have gotten.
They still do live shows, limited touring here and there. Would you go see, from a personal perspective, would you go see The Who these days without Entwistle and, of course, without Keith Moon?
No, I'd have no desire. You know what? I used to do that kind of thing, but even now, like I would, and I saw McCartney once, and it's just like, you know, you've kind of coasted on what you did post turning 30, and it was to be able to say, well, I saw this guy, but I heard on YouTube a Who show from like 2000. So we're going back almost two decades now, and I just, they were so bad. And they just, in Entwistle still at the same time, but there's no moon. They were just terrible. And they were not, in some ways, they were worlds better. But come 1978 with the Who Are You album, Keith Moon was just so bloated and he wasn't playing well. And there are some interesting concerts from like Chicago in 79, but they're young men at the time then. And now it's just, no, I wouldn't. But that sort of period and this, we have to remember, because we take live albums for granted, really, but within the chronology of live albums, the technology did not exist to capture huge volume well on tape until 1968. Think about it. There are live albums in rock and roll before that, from like 66, the Kinks and the Stones, 67, but there's really nothing that's sort of like Cream, Blue Cheer, Zeppelin, Who, Hendrix, capturing of that kind of decibel wattage. And so this was a pristine recording that sounds even better now with this cleaned up, nice, fancy release.
Well, you can check it out and also make sure you read Colin's piece at rollingstone.com on the Who live at Fillmore East 1968. Great stuff. And next week, I'm excited about this too. We'll talk about two of my favorite movies of all time from two of my favorite directors.
Two of the most disturbing movies of all time, too, wouldn't you say? And Hitchcock's Vertigo and Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. And I was at, what's that film with that guy from The Office, A Quiet Place, the other day.
Oh, yeah, Krasinski, yeah.
Yeah, I was struck by just how passive the film was. And Welles and Hitchcock, they were not passive. They made these films where they basically said, we are the deciders. We are the holders of dominion. We are giving you this experience on our terms. And if I was the type of person who used the word bro, and I was at a film, either of these, and I turned to my bromance companion afterwards, I'd be like, that was effed up, bro. Like, just crazy, these two films. I don't even know which one's more disturbing. Probably Touch of Evil, but Vertigo's sort of about necrophilia.
Yeah, and they're both so far ahead of their time and so weirdly out of place at the time they were made.
Do you know that Orson Welles, he hated Vertigo? He thought it was a joke.
Really?
You'd think that Welles, of all people, would really get Vertigo because it's the type of like film that's so weird that Welles could have done and thought, you know what, I can get major studio backing on this one. Of course, he couldn't. And it seemed like it would be right up his street, but he said to Peter Bogdanovich, like, I cannot believe how bad that film and The Searchers by John Ford are.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about both of them. Looking forward to it next Tuesday here on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
We'll see you then. 18 minutes after the hour. When we return, we get a little NFL draft preview from Vinny Iyer of the Sporting News. Tomorrow on the program, good stuff. Bruce Pratt will be here in the house. Sports Lit 101 author Steve Allman talks about bad stories. What the hell just happened to our country? That's the subtitle. Carrie's looking around like, what's going on? Is there something wrong? No, that's the title. Subtitle of the book. Also tomorrow, Kelly Lester from the Spitfire Grill, the upcoming production at Penobscot Theater. Andy Hart of Patriots Football Weekly talking NFL draft. Kyle Draper of NBC Sports Boston. And a whole lot more later this week on the program. Bob Soucy, voice of the Patriots. Author Robert Kersen talks about Rocket Men, all about Apollo 8. Jameel Demby, who hopes to hear his name called in the NFL draft this weekend. And children's TV producer Marty Croft later this week as well on Downtown. Let's check your weather, brought to you by Quirk Motor City Used Vehicle Center, with locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland.
It's your car. Find it at QuirkAuto.com. Bruce